It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The summer travel season is just around the corner, and this hour, we're going to travel around the world in five true stories as told to a live audience at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was put together by Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and I kicked the evening off with some of my own thoughts on travel. We have some wonderful storytellers coming up tonight. Of course, the theme of the evening is travel. And I love to travel. I used to say that I love to go on vacation, but I had an epiphany a few years ago. This was an epiphany sparked by a blog post that informed me that I had never actually taken a vacation in my entire life. This blog post informed me that I take trips. And I think a lot of us do. And I know that my way of traveling was very much shaped by my parents. When we took these family vacations when I was young, we treated it like an endurance sport. You know, we would go as far, as fast as our conversion van would carry us. We would spend as little money as possible, and we would see, do, and learn as much as we possibly could. And we thought we were having fun. We did laugh a lot, but I think mostly we just bonded through shared misery and hardship. And you know, the stories that endure from those trips are not about the amazing things we saw or did. They're about the complete disasters, right? So, like, there was a trip out west. My mom decided that we would each only get to bring two changes of clothes. So that would really keep down the luggage in the back. And so about 3 days into the trip, that was the time when everybody was supposed to shower and change clothes. And so we did, and we were all cleaned up, and we drove into this little town, and we went to a donut shop, and we got a box of donuts and a jug of milk, and we hit the road, and I was sitting in my mom's lap up front, and my brother, my middle brother, was standing behind her seat holding on, and I threw up on my mom's lap. And my brother saw that and threw up on my mom's head. It dripped all down her body. But, you know, we saw Yellowstone, and that's the story we tell about that trip. Anyway, I think about, as an adult, I think back on those trips, and I think about just, they were feats of strength for my parents, because we'd always go for 2 weeks, and my dad would drive almost the whole time. I don't know how they did it, but my mom was always just relentlessly positive. We are having such a wonderful adventure. We're so lucky that we get to do this. So I nicknamed her Travel Yoda. Adventure we are having. Fortunate are we. And of course, I made fun of her relentlessly. Anyway, fast forward 25 years, and last summer, I took my family on the trip of a lifetime. We went to Isle Royale National Park. It is an island in the middle of Lake Superior, one of the least visited national parks in the United States. We went backpacking for 5 days. There are no motorized vehicles allowed on the island. It's full of beaver and moose and loons and just a very few wolves, although they're working on that. It's amazing. There was just this, well, a couple little problems. One was the only week that we could go fell during my daughter's birthday. And the day of her birthday, her 13th birthday, we really had to hike 11 miles. And she knew it was gonna happen, and she had told me it was okay, and I did my best to make the day fun. I brought all these little presents. She got a present an hour. And she only cried 3 times, which was really very reasonable considering. And I kept saying, honey, we're having such a great adventure. It's so fun that we get to do this. Oh, imagine when you get to tell your friends about this day. So yes, I've turned into my mother. And when we got home from the trip and several weeks had gone past and our blisters had healed, and we'd forgotten a little bit about some of the misery, my daughter said to me, can we go back to Isle Royale next year? And I thought, I'm raising the next generation's travel Yoda. I could not be prouder. All right, let's get to the main event this evening. Our first storyteller of the evening is Vanessa Miller Hughes. She is a reporter at the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Welcome, Vanessa.
Yes, thanks. Hi. Yeah, Charity, I have a lot of respect for you and your mom for being so positive, because I'm not the positive travel mom. I'm definitely the mom that's like, we're never coming back. We're never doing this again. You all are grounded for the rest of your lives. So, if you don't stop fighting. Along that those lines, I am the mother currently of a delightful 8-year-old and twin 5-year-olds, which means last year at this time, I was the mother of a delightful 7-year-old and 4-year-old twins. And many of you might be thinking, like, oh, that's wonderful for you guys. You were probably starting to sort of emerge from the fog of twin infants and getting your feet under you and feeling really good about them being more, you know, sufficient and sleeping through the night. But if you're thinking that, you would be wrong, because we were not blessed with kids that were sleeping through the night at like 3 months or 6 months or a year or even like a year and a half or even then, actually. So like a lot during the night, they would have me coming in to like rub their back or their leg or, I don't know, you know, scare monsters away or change their sheets, all sorts of fun adventures all during the night. And so I was pretty tired most of the time, even then. And so when I got the opportunity to go to a Education Writers Association conference in Los Angeles, I was pretty excited. Partly because I was like, great, I get to be re-inspired and, you know, like talk with other journalists and get some great story ideas. But mostly I was excited for 3 like uninterrupted nights of sleep. I also was kind of excited to like get on an airplane and travel without 3 crazy kids. Unfortunately, on the way there, I had the random coincidence of sitting next to a mom who was traveling by herself with twin babies. I was like, who does that? I don't do that. But I was felt like specifically skilled to help her, so I did. And I like held a baby the whole time, which was kind of fine because the baby was adorable and obviously loved me. So I was... I felt like good about being helpful, but I definitely was going to stick to my sleeping plan in Los Angeles. Except they actually kept us busy with official conference duties for much of the time, way later than I thought. So I didn't get to do the sleeping thing, and I was still tired, but I for sure was going to sleep on the way home. And everything was going according to plan. Like, I got there early. I got on the airplane. I was going to fall asleep before it even took off. And I wasn't even going to know that I was flying. It was going to be amazing. And I'm kind of starting to actually fall asleep, I think. And I hear like a little like kind of mumbly, gruff voice down the aisle a ways. And I, you know, it stood out because she was a little bit louder than normal. And I do remember thinking like, oh, that's unfortunate, forever has to sit by that person. So the woman with the gruff, loud, mumbly voice is coming down the aisle. And then it did start to enter my consciousness like, oh, what if she's going to sit next to me? But then I was like, no, because what are the odds? It's a huge airplane, you know? So I just keep my eyes closed. And then I do hear her stop. And then she says something effective like, excuse me, I think this is me. And I just am thinking like, I'm just going to keep my eyes closed and maybe she'll go away or maybe she'll go find another seat. I had to let her in, and she like proceeded to tell me all of the reasons she was flying, which was that she has apparently an amazing son who is graduating and was the commencement speaker and was valedictorian and had like a 5.9 GPA and cured cancer and won the Nobel Prize and sprouted wings. And he was like, he was amazing. So I like indulged her and I was like, that's great. I'm so happy for you. I also am very proud of my son when he sleeps through the night. But I right now I'm going to try to sleep. So I was close to falling asleep until I feel this like tapping on my shoulder, like tap, tap, tap. And I look over and I'm like, yeah, you know, and again, she's waking me up. So I'm like, kind of like jarred awake. And I'm like, can I help you? And she's like, are you okay? And I'm like, I don't know. Do I have blood dripping from my eyeballs? Do I look like something's wrong? Like I was firm. I was like, yeah, I'm okay, except for I'm trying to sleep. And somebody keeps tapping me on the shoulder. You. So I do what I'm doing. I fall back asleep, or I try to, and I kind of have my eyes closed and everything, and I'm pretty close. And then, that's right, tapping my shoulder again. I was like, can I help you, or what's going on? And she was like, can I give you my credit card to, and if the lady comes around, will you get me a vodka? Because I think I'm gonna try to take a little nap. And I was like, no, no, I'm not gonna get you a drink because I'm trying to sleep, but I can't because you keep tapping me on the shoulder. So she got the message, I think, and she stopped talking, and I closed my eyes, and I was, you know, close to falling asleep. But of course, at that moment, we hit like the worst turbulence in the history of the world. And it's often, you know, pretty helpful to be asleep right now, but I'm not. I'm wide awake because crazy tapper, and because now the turbulence is so bad. But turns out, neighbor lady has fallen fast asleep. She's like rock solid asleep. And like, we land in Chicago, and she was like, oh my gosh, you guys, did I say anything crazy last night? And I was like, yes, you did. And she was like, because I was wasted. And I was like, of course you were. Yeah. And now, not because of some awesome party in LA or because of some delicious cocktail, I too was wasted because of lack of sleep. But at least it felt like I was home.
This hour, we're traveling around the world in 5 true stories, told live at a storytelling event at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism. More stories coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're traveling around the world in 5 true stories told live at a storytelling event at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and our next storyteller is Jeremy Mims of Iowa City. He is a high school coach and mentor. Here's Jeremy's story.
Will all the black people in here raise their hand real quick? Hi, Dad. So what happens to me quite often, when I'm walking around downtown Iowa City, and I'll be walking with one of my white friends, and a black person who I've never seen before in my life will cross our path, and I will see them, and I'll give a little nod, and they'll nod back. And then I always get this question, do you know that person? And I say, no. And then they give me this strange look, and then I feel like I have to explain to them something that I don't know how to explain to them. So anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about a trip that I took this past summer to South Africa. I was invited by a friend of mine who's a faculty member, former faculty member at the University of Iowa, and he was going on a research project and had a grant that was funding everything, so all I had to do was buy a plane ticket, and everything else was taken care of. So I was fortunate to go along on this trip. So we started off, we flew out, we landed in Paris, and we had a 12-hour layover in Paris, and I'd never been to Paris. So we took a train, and we went to Saint-Denis, a little part of Paris where there's a lot of African immigrants live in that area of town. And as soon as we got off the train, the very first thing that happens, we ended up going one stop too far. And so our ticket that lets us out of the train station wouldn't work. And so we're standing there as tens of dozens of people are walking past and going through. And an individual stops, and he taps a guy on the shoulder in front of him. He says, hey, put your ticket in. The guy puts his ticket in, and the guy walks through, and as soon as he walks through, he holds the door. And these immigrants hold the door, and they say, go, 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 and they push us through. And so that's my first experience in Paris, France, is these African immigrants helping us out, get out of the train station so we don't get stuck there, and we don't miss our next flight 12 hours later. So we spent a little time in Paris. We head on, and we get to Johannesburg, and that's where we stayed for our time there. And as soon as we get to Johannesburg, we land and we're in a rush. We have to race because we have tickets to go to a soccer match. And so we run to the hotel, we shower, we hop in another Uber, we head straight to this Premier League soccer match, and we walk in. As we're walking in, this is my first time ever. As a Black American, this is the first time ever I've stepped foot in Africa. And ever since I got off the plane, everyone I see is Black. Everyone looks like me. Maybe a little darker shade, but everyone looks like me. And so we walk into the soccer match, and we're sitting there in a stadium full of 50,000 people. And the only white person I remember being there is my buddy Jason. And in that moment, I wondered if they would remember him, any of those people, or if he was invisible to them because he was just this person passing through. And it made me wonder if he was experiencing similar things to what I experience when I'm here in my hometown. Am I invisible to all the people around me every single day? Unless I know you, do you remember me? So we're at the soccer match, and we spent some time there. We left, we went out and grabbed drinks at a nice restaurant, had some fun. We were kind of digesting just what our first experiences were here in South Africa. And then we went to, the next day we had plans to go to the Apartheid Museum. So the Apartheid Museum, when you get your ticket, it gives you two options. It says white or non-white. And there's two entrances that you walk in. They sit side by side. And so we both decided we're going to walk in the non-white one. I think that's what my ticket said, and that's the one Jason was hoping he got. He wanted to go through that. And Jason had done research on South Africa as part of his master's, and he'd done a lot of work. And so going through this was great because I have a historian with me who actually, that's what he does for a living, who can actually tell me the history of South Africa while I'm walking through this museum. So I have like a walking tour guide with me. And we're both experiencing this all for the first time. And so as we walk in, we're reading through things, and he's explaining some of the background, and he's helping me process and understand what's going on. And so as I'm learning about apartheid, it's interesting because I'm learning about this time in South Africa when they're choosing to implement laws to enact apartheid shortly after America was enacting laws to try and desegregate, which is a fascinating thing. Apartheid didn't end until the 80s, and I was alive then. The civil rights movement happened well before I was born. And so going into a country where it was kind of on opposite trajectory was just a very fascinating and unique experience. As we're walking through, we walk in, there's this room, and it has to do with the political executions that took place in South Africa during a lot of the things that were going on. And the way that they have it represented, a lot of those executions were done by hanging. And so it's a room that, if you imagine a room that's maybe the top seven rows in this room, wall to wall, and nooses hang from the ceiling. And so as I see it, I don't want to go in, right? As a Black man in America, that has very significant meaning to me. And I stand there at the door for probably 5 minutes, and Jason goes in, and he's looking at things, and he's reading it, and he's aware that I'm there, but he's not going to say anything. He's not going to push me to go through it. And I could go a different way. And I watch as people walk in, and some people, they're just interested. So finally, I decided to walk in, and I walked through that room. And the emotion and the weight of what's going on, these are two different things, but the meaning is similar. And it has meaning both to many of the South Africans as well as the meanings to me, even if they are different and they come from a little bit different place. So we finish our time at the Apartheid Museum. And later on, we go to Constitution Hill. And at Constitution Hill, there's a prison where Gandhi was kept. And at that prison, not only was Gandhi there, but also Nelson Mandela. And so I had the opportunity to stand in a doorway that Nelson Mandela stood in. And I have a photograph, and they have a photograph of Nelson Mandela standing there. And there's a photograph of me standing in that same doorway years later. So all of this happens. And, you know, we see some other things. We have a lot of fun. We have fun. And people ask me, was it a fun trip? And I say, I don't think fun's the right word. That's not what it was for me. It was an experience. It was something greater than that, and it was a learning opportunity. So we find this brewery, a little local brewery that we go to, And we go in there and we're kind of processing everything and decompressing and talking through things. And we talk with one of the guys that works there. And this bartender is asking us about America. And he's asking me, what is your experience? What's it like? What about that guy you guys call president? And he starts asking me about different things. He's interested just in America's way of life. What are the schools like? And I say, well, you know, it depends where you are. We have schools where we have a lot of black kids. We have schools with a lot of white kids. We have some schools that have a lot of both, but in general, our schools are fairly separate if you look. How is it where people live? I said, well, it's pretty different. We don't all live together. And even in the hometown I'm from, in Iowa City, we are very segregated. And so he keeps pressing me and keeps asking more questions. And he finally says at the end of it, he goes, oh, so you have apartheid in America. And I sat there for a second, I thought about it. And I was like, yeah, we do. So we're on this trip and we're going through all of these things and we head back, and as we're coming back to the US, I was still decompressing. I was still thinking about everything that I'd gone through and what it was and what it meant to me. And I found myself walking down the street one day with one of my friends, and a black person walked past me, and I looked at them. They looked at me. I nodded. They nodded. And my friend said, hey, do you know them? And I said, yes, I do.
Jeremy Mims of Iowa City, sharing his story of a paradigm-shifting trip to South Africa. Next up, Jen Rauway. She is a professional pet sitter who grew up in Solon.
So I'm going to tell you a story. I was 15, going on 16. I had my permit for about a year, and my best friend had just been given her freshly given permit that September. We were planning to go skiing in Dubuque. Anybody been to Sundown, right? It's top of the line here in Iowa for skiing. So, you know, when you got rental skis, it's all you got. So we were super excited. I had a nephew at the time. He was 3. So Kendra and I, my best friend, were put in charge of watching this kid because mom and dad were over it at this point. They're getting into their 60s. They had enough. They're just going to let the 2 kids handle it. It's the 23rd of December. We're watching my nephew while my sister moves from house to house in Woodland Park, Colorado. The 23rd, we're sitting around at night, and Dad said, you know, I think Carol, my sister, would really like to see her son on Christmas Day. I think we should drive out and surprise her. My mom immediately said, I don't think that's a good idea. And Dad said, no, it's a great idea. So I'm sitting at the kitchen table. I'm watching this go back and forth. And I know it's a terrible idea. I have every indication in my brain that this is the worst idea that Dad's had in 20 minutes. Like, it is just awful. So Mom finally just said, you know what? You're going to do it. Just do it. Just go. So I called my best friend and I said, we can't go to Sundown. We got to go. You got to go with me. I'm not doing this by myself. So come with me. We'll watch the nephew. And Dad says, you know what? We'll take the dog. He has a beagle. And the beagle's name was Mercy. Dad had this brilliant idea with this beagle. To control its digestive system, he gave it garlic. Because it's cheaper than, I don't know. It's cheaper than buying better food for the dog. So he got garlic, gave this dog garlic. Now, this was, and I know what you're thinking, by far the gassiest dog I have ever met to this day, and I work at a dog kennel. So it's god-awful. So he says, we're going to leave in the morning, 6 a.m., first light. We're going to get into the Volkswagen Rabbit. Let me repeat that. Volkswagen Rabbit. So we're like, okay. I call my best friend. I said, you got to go with me. So she said, fine. She'll go with me. So we pack up our stuff. She's going to spend the night because we know that Dad's not going to leave at 6 a.m. He's going to wake up at 2 a.m., can't sleep. We're going to get in the car, and we're going to drive to Colorado. Sure enough, 3 a.m., not anywhere near light out. He says, let's load up. So we get in the car, get the little kid strapped in. She's in the front seat. I'm in the back seat with my nephew. And he comes out carrying this fat beagle. And I'm like, what are you doing, Dad? And Dad says, your mom says I can't leave Mercy at home. She's got to go with us. Well, I can't blame my mom. Like, there's no way I would want to live with this beagle. So we get in the car and we start driving. Now, the direct route that what he told me is we have to go through Nebraska, which apparently is the closest route from A to B. So Nebraska is super straight, super flat. Really, there's nothing there but Stuckey's restaurants. So if anybody who is under the age of probably 45 imagine Country Kitchen, way, way, way worse. This it's terrible. It's and if you go through Nebraska now, there's a reason why you see shrubbery and no building, because those used to be Stuckey's, and I think somebody burned them to the ground sometime in the 90s. So we get in the, we're driving, we stop at a Stuckey's. There's not really a lot else going on in the middle of Nebraska. I mean, they're cow pasture restaurants. So we go in, dog's in the car, it's fine. He says, I want to sit where we can see the dog. Sure enough, they put us there. There was flaw in that thinking, because the beagle can also see us. So the beagle's extremely upset that we're in there and she's out there. So she kind of honks the horn a couple times. Beep, beep. Okay, beep, beep. Let's go see what the dog's doing. So dad starts to come out. The beagle sees dad, gets excited, starts doing one of these on the window, right? He starts scratching on the window, hits the locks. So now we got all four doors locked, keys in the ignition, because who's going to steal a Volkswagen rabbit? He takes his pocket knife out, and the old Volkswagens, you could pop the trunk by just sticking it in the lock and kind of wiggling it. So he pops the trunk. Great. Now we're in the trunk, but there's a back seat, and it's solid. But there's a hole where it flips down, and it makes into two things. It makes into an armrest or a jump seat. So the narrow space is about a foot tall and about 6 inches wide. Who fits through that? A three-year-old in cowboy boots fits through this perfectly fine. Send the kid in. Three-year-old, he goes up front. He knows what he's supposed to do. He sits in the front seat. He now looks us dead in the eye and realizes there's keys to the ignition. And he knows how to start a car because Grandpa thought it'd be fun to teach Shane how to drive a car. So now you have three people, two teenagers and a grown man, saying, okay, please don't start the car. Just unlock the car. Unlock the car. Unlock the car. Someone calls the cops. Of course they call the cops. We are crazy people in the parking lot of Stuckey's, and there's a beagle that has now taken over our lives. So now the police officer's standing with two teenagers and a perfectly grown man saying, okay, Shane, what's your name? Shane, pull up the lock. Just pull up the lock. I got a cookie. Pull up the lock. This kid does not want a cookie. He wants to win, you know, the Indianapolis 500 going through Nebraska. So finally, I think, this is just my theory, I think the beagle farted because he's trying to roll down the window, and it's one of these. And finally, he rolls down the window enough. Dad reaches in, flop the lock, get the thing, get the beagle, get the kid, go back in to finish. So we get in the car, driving, he's in the back seat. Finally, we're like, pull over, Shane's got to poop. So we get out, have to find the only shrubbery, which is behind another Stuckey's, so he will go to the bathroom. So at this point, we're ready to get to Colorado. I have had it. We are driving as fast as humanly possible, and this little Volkswagen was being pushed to the limit. We get to Colorado, knock on the door. Nobody's home because they weren't expecting us. So now it's the day before Christmas in 1983. That means nothing's open. There's no cell phone. We're standing on a mountain in Woodland Park, Colorado, trying to figure out how to get into this house. Again, a three-year-old will fit through the window, no problem. No problem whatsoever. So the neighbors call the police. There's one neighbor, he sees us, calls the police. We do get in, finally. At this point, we are now super disappointed we just didn't go skiing. This has been a nightmare. And my dad says, so what do you guys want to do? And we said, I don't know, like, what do you do in Colorado? I have no idea. I've been here, like, once, and I don't know, what do you do? And my sister says, well, you could go skiing. And we're like, they're skiing? Literally, they're skiing in Colorado? So we got in the Volkswagen Rabbit, and Dad let us drive by ourselves to Broadmoor, Colorado, which is a giant hill that goes straight down to a glass building. It's just straight down glass building. If you don't stop, you never ski again. Dollars to it. So we had the time of our lives. We went skiing, had a great time, and there was some photos. We actually didn't stay standing up more than about 30 seconds for 2 days straight. Had a blast. Get done. Glad we went to Colorado. Did not regret it. Happy to be going home without the child that will poop only outside. Like, at this point, we're thrilled. We get in the car, and I distinctly remind me of my best friend digging in the bag. She's digging, and Dad's in the front seat because he's got to drive us at least long enough to get out of sight of other adults, right? Got to get you away from the sister and brother-in-law who might be responsible. She gets digging, and she takes something, walks into the house, comes back out, says, I'm ready to go. I figured, okay. So we get in the car, we're driving down the road, and I said, what'd you do? And she said, I put the dog's garlic powder on the kitchen counter. That's my story.
Jen Rauway. She works in Iowa City and grew up in Solon, Iowa. This hour, we're traveling around the world in five true stories told live at a storytelling event at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism. More stories coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're traveling around the world in five true stories told live at a storytelling event at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and we've got two stories left to go. Our next storyteller is Karsten Hassman. He's a student at the University of Iowa who grew up in Cedar Falls.
So after high school, I took a trip as a missionary on a ship. Now, this was no ordinary ship. This was like a ship with 400 people on it. And the one thing that I learned from the ship was grace and patience. Now, you can imagine 400 people living on a ship, the toasters in the morning, right? You got to be very patient. But these weren't like the put the bread in, click the button. No, these were like rotational toasters, right? And with 400 people getting in line, with only two rotational toasters, yeah, that gets. So I would put my toast in the morning, go sit down, wait for the toast to toast, right? Well, I would come back and the toast would not be there. I had to be very gracious there and patient for the toast to come out. But anyway, on the ship, I was part of the maintenance team, which consisted of welders, plumbers, carpenters, and HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. And I was a welder, part of this team. Now, we were 11 guys, roughly, right? And we took care of the whole ship. Like, we did everything. If there was something broken, we would repair it. If there was a hole in the side of the ship, we would go and repair it. Okay, so one day, we decided, you know what? Let's go take a camping trip. That was a great idea. Because the whole maintenance team would have to leave the ship. I'm sure nothing would go wrong there. So we were in the Canary Islands, and we decided, you know what? We need some team bonding time. And we didn't really know what it took when we started this idea of camping in the Canary Islands. You can't just go into the field or the woods like you would here and just set up a tent, sleeping bag, and just camp, right? You actually have to ask the government for permission to go camp in up on the mountains. So we got the permit in the end. Now, you might think, how are they gonna take a 2.5 hour trip without a car? Well, we ended up getting this massive van and we started driving up. Now, we got out a little bit late because we had to work that day and it was already getting dark. So we got up there around 11 p.m., but no one ever looked at the weather forecast. And we only got sleeping bags because we're on a ship, who needs tents? So we had the bright idea, and no one decided like to look at their GPS or anything, so we just started walking in one direction. By the time we got to the very, very top, it was midnight, we were at the very top, and we found out that we were in the wrong location. Yeah. So we walked all the way back to the vans where they were parked, and then walked past them on the other direction. Now, we were 11 guys, right? Average age, 24. Pretty stupid age to be at. So, we got to the camping location. It was just a dirt patch up on the top of the mountain. And it was already like 1 a.m. We've spent half the night hiking. And it just started sprinkling. And we had still to build a fire and put our sleeping bags down. And thankfully, someone decided to bring a whole roll of large garbage bags. And when it started pouring, what we did was cut the bottom of the garbage bag open and tape two garbage bags together and slide our sleeping bag into the garbage bag. So we slept in garbage bags overnight. So we all slept, and I'm an early riser. I mean, I got up at 5:30, sun was just coming up. Beautiful scenery on top of the mountain, overlooking the whole island. And behind me, there were just body bags, it looked like. Just, I mean, one was still twitching, so I knew they were still alive. And so in the morning, everyone got up. We bundled up. Everything was muddy. We had a good downpour. The garbage bags were large enough where we could actually pull everything over our heads, but we didn't have any tents or anything put over our heads. We weren't that smart. So in the morning, we had everything packed up. We started hiking back, and an official came to meet us, and she asked for our permits. Now you might be asking, this is Spain. They speak Spanish. Now, one thing that I learned throughout my travels is if you encounter an official, you never speak the language that they speak. Gets you out of a lot of trouble. So we had a little bit of a difficulty. I speak Spanish personally, but I didn't tell her that I spoke Spanish. That would not have ended well. So we showed her the permit, and then in the end, it turned out we did not camp in the right spot. We didn't know what to do. I mean, we weren't gonna be there again. So we were like, whatever. We spent the night, we've already camped. Let's get out of here before we get into more trouble. The plan was to go down to a little village near the coast and to go eat at a restaurant, which you enter in a cave. The restaurant was within a cave that overlooked the whole island with a beautiful scenery. But we got there, and we started talking to the locals while we waited for the restaurant to open. It opened at 11. I think it was a Sunday or whatever. And we got introduced to this thing called jamón serrano. Has anyone tried it here? Yeah, it's some really good stuff. If you ever get the chance to try it, jamón serrano. Amazing stuff. So everyone in my team fell in love with this stuff, and they were just chowing down on this. And by the time the restaurant opened, we were already full. We got into the restaurant, we sat down, the scenery was just astounding. And everyone ordered the food, everyone ate half of it. We packed up the rest and got out of there. We didn't want to spend too much time, we got to get back to the ship, make sure it's still floating. And so we got to the ship, we were soaked by that time, because it rained, right? We were muddy. But we had smiles on our faces, a good story to tell, and the ship didn't sink, so we still had a home. Thank you.
Storyteller Karsten Hassman with a tale of a poorly planned camping expedition. Our final storyteller is Sarah McGurk. She is an adjunct professor in writing and community outreach. She grew up in Freehold, New Jersey. Sarah McGurk.
So, yeah, as a kid in Jersey, my family never really took trips, right? We would go to the Jersey Shore, and we would go to a place called Lake Wallenpaupack in the Poconos. And that was it. And so, at a certain point, I have two sisters. We felt like we'd never been anywhere. We'd only been on the East Coast. And my little sister, upon graduating college, it was her big dream. She wanted to take a European tour, you know what I mean? One of those, like, girl trips, right? My parents wouldn't let her unless she had some friends. She had a friend. The friend ditches, right, like a month beforehand. Not gonna happen. She says, okay, well, you know, how about Sarah? Sarah can go with you. And I'm like, I don't have that kind of money. What are you gonna do, right? She's like, we'll pay for your flights, take care of your sister, right? So I'm like, okay, it's gonna be great. European tour, woohoo, with the girls. And then I have an older sister, and my mom gets to think, and she's like, oh no, what are we gonna do? It's a sister's trip, but Emily can't go. Emily got a new job. I want all my three daughters to go together. It could be a last hurrah before they go off and get married. None of us are like anywhere near there, right? So Emily takes the one sort of vacation she's going to have all year from her job. And we all three go on this European trip. Now I'll give you some context. My two sisters don't get along at all. It's like polar opposites. They're only 4 years apart. But Rebecca is the youngest and everything gets handed to her. And Emily is like working her booty off, doing her thing. Artist. And I'm just out here in Iowa, separated, very separated. So we're going on the European tour. It's great, girls' trip. You know, all Rebecca wants to do is see the food and see the sights and see the Louvre. Very popular museum, I hear. Very popular. And all Emily wants to do, right, she's like, I work for a living. I want to party. I want to meet guys, right? So she just wants to, like, drink and see the clubs. And all my life, I've been in the middle. I've been very diplomatic with these women. So, you know, Emily has her late nights, and Rebecca wants to have her early morning brunch and whatever, and the whole thing's a mess. At a certain point, we're in Prague, and Emily decides that this is the time to just, like, chug some absinthe. Just go missing. Yeah, chug some absinthe. And, you know, we find her eventually. She's, like, on another planet for sure. And they get into a brawl. They're, like, fighting on the bridge, fighting all the way home. We're like, come on, we gotta go back to the hotel. Let's go, let's go. Finally, we get back to the hotel. Now, I had broken my arm, right? This is way before this. And I had just gotten out of the cast right before the trip, right? So I'm in my sling, hanging out, going to Europe. It was great. And so I end up having to bust up this fight between my sisters. Physical altercation, right? So, bust it up, lock Emily in the bathroom. Rebecca's on Skype. Rebecca's like, with my dad on Skype. She's like, I want you to pay for a flight. I'm going to Paris 2 days early. I'm leaving them. He does it, right? So next morning, Becky's on a plane, going to Paris to meet her boyfriend. Now this is the same morning, best morning of the trip for me. Now it's just me and Emily, we're hanging out. We go to the Kafka Museum. Amazing. I'm a poet. I love museums. I love writers. I'm a filmmaker. We go to the Carla Zeman Museum. I love it. Incredible. So that all goes down that morning, and I come out of the museum. Now I'm trying to put you in the spot because this is the headspace I'm in at the time, fighting with the sisters, the whole deal. Finally, a really nice morning, and I go to this free Wi-Fi garden outside the museum, and this is 2016. I finally check my text for the first time that day, and I have a text from my ex that says, did you hear about Orlando? And we hadn't spoken in a long time. And so, yeah, I'm brought back to that spot where I realized, you know, I'm so far away from home, and I hadn't known for a very long time. And I think back to, you know, a matter of hours, but to me that was a long time, because right now we think about tragedy, right? And if you think about all of the massacres that have happened over the past however many years, you typically hear about it on your phone or your iPad, right when you wake up in the morning in bed. We don't have sort of the JFK or the John Lennon or the 9/11 kind of deal. So it, in a certain sense, I felt like I was getting that kind of experience. I also was already sort of stranger in a strange land. I didn't know how anybody in Prague, who in Prague was gonna care. At the time, this was the highest death toll of any massacre in America. It was 50 killed and 53 injured. I hadn't come out to my parents at the time. I had only been out to my sisters for a little while. And everything shifted. I thought a little more deeply about sort of the dungeons and the mirrors and the maze of the Kafka Museum. And so we went about our day, right? You're traveling. We went into bookshops and cafes, and I told my sister about it. And she didn't really realize that I felt as though I had a stake in it. All day I was thinking about, you know, that could have been me, that could have been my friends. I've been fighting with my family all this trip, not realizing that in Iowa I've definitely made a new family for myself. In any case, Emily and I jet set to Berlin, and we didn't know what to do with ourselves. I was the person who always did the planning, and Emily was just kind of like, where can we get a cheap beer? So we're just kind of stumbling around, looking for museums, whatever. And in the streets, kind of all of a sudden, we see a vigil, like a marching. They got the candles, they got the flags, a vigil, very small. But I had never experienced a feeling like this, where it was like I couldn't not just go. And that's what I did. I, without saying anything, just went. And I was in with them. And Emily, of course, was like, what are you doing? Hey. I know they're gay, but like, come on, I don't care. Like, we can go to the gay club tonight. Like, what are you doing? And I said, Emily, this is all there is to do. So we join, we're kind of in the march, and yeah, some people spoke English, but we didn't really talk to anybody. We just did it. And it was this weird, beautiful, magical thing. And I felt confused, but like delighted that people in Berlin, that this happened and people in Berlin rose up and chose to do something. I got back and my dad, not knowing, you know, how I identify, he said, well, yeah, when the terrorists win, you know, they'll come for the gays first. So, you know, we got to be real about that. And my mom said, it must be really tough for the parents because, you know, now there's no hope. Their kids are dead. There's no chance for them for rehabilitation. After that happened, I basically more or less came out because of my reactions to statements like that. And my sisters, you know, after this kind of heinous voyage together, I don't know if they fully understood, but they came to understand that they needed to support me. And they needed to sort of put their differences aside and talk to my parents. And we had our sister thing. Yeah, we can end it there. Why not?
Storyteller Sarah McGirt. She grew up in Freehold, New Jersey, and lives in Iowa City. You've been listening to True Stories About Travel, told live at a storytelling event at Merge in downtown Iowa City on April 12th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism. Our audio engineer is Jim Davies. Our producer, Caitlin Harrop. A big thank you to Heather Spangler and the Foundations of Event Management class at the University of Iowa for making this happen. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.